Hello, I'm delighted to say that this episode of Film Stories is sponsored by NordVPN. Now, if you're unfamiliar with a VPN, it is a virtual private network, and it's a service that basically allows you to pretend that your computer or device is in a different country. So you set a virtual location for your device, and that means that suddenly you can get access to things that otherwise you might not be able to see. So for instance, if you're a Netflix subscriber, you set your NordVPN to America, then you get a plethora of options from American Netflix rather than UK Netflix, which is where this podcast is based. You can do this with all sorts of things. You switch the virtual location of your VPN service, and then you get access to TV shows, to films, to sporting events, streaming services and such like that you just wouldn't be able to get from the UK. A quick mention too for the cybersecurity features of NordVPN, including shielding your online activities, encrypting your connection, and using threat protection as well. To take advantage of this, you need to go to nordvpn.com/filmstories. That's nordvpn.com/filmstories. And you can try it risk-free with a 30-day money-back guarantee to get the best discount off your NordVPN plan. If you go to that Film Stories link, that will give you an extra 4 months free on top of the 2-year plan. And again, there's no risk with Nord's 30-day money-back guarantee. And you will also find the link in the podcast episode description box. Hello, this is Simon Brew. I'm the editor of Film Stories magazine, and a very warm welcome to a very special episode of the Film Stories podcast.
Come with me.
And I show you how deep the rabbit hole goes.
In movies that had stories.
That the story just sucks them in.
This is just the beginning.
Film Stories. We would be honored if you would join us.
Hello and a very warm welcome to Film Stories with Simon Brew. I am Simon Brew, as always, that's all you need to know about me. The aim of the podcast, though, is, as the title suggests, to tell the stories of films. I tend to talk about development stories, marketing stories, release stories, or distribution stories, all really those ingredients that go towards making the films that we know and sometimes love. Just that, the films that we know and sometimes love. The films I tend to cover on this podcast lean more towards the mainstream than anything else. They're films I'm interested in or invested in to some degree. Try not to do snark. I try not to punch down. This podcast is a celebration of cinema and a real appreciation that somehow, despite all the difficulties, films get made. This particular episode that you've found is one of my occasional specials where I bring in a filmmaker to talk about their latest release or their body of work. You get a real mixed bag here, because I'm delighted to welcome to the Film Stories podcast Alexander Payne, the director behind films such as Sideways, Election, Citizen Ruth, Downsizing, The Descendants, and most recently the film The Holdovers, which at the point this podcast is being released has just popped up in UK cinemas. Now, I really love The Holdovers. It stars Paul Giamatti. I'm a huge Paul Giamatti fan, and I would imagine it's about to get a lot of interest from awards bodies. It already has at the point this podcast is being recorded. This conversation with Alexander Payne, though, as you hear, goes off in all sorts of directions, really. It's not, even though it was done as part and parcel of the London junket for the film, we seem to talk about, well, you'll hear, really. It went into places I wasn't quite expecting. I hope you enjoy the conversation as much as I did. Now, it was recorded remotely, so you get a little bit of jumpiness in the recording here, which I've done my best to level out. You still will hear parts of it, but I just wanted to leave Alexander Payne's words as open and as pure as when he spoke them to me, really. So, a couple of films are mentioned. We do talk about Downsizing a little bit. Citizen Ruth, that he mentions, was his breakthrough feature, the film that really put it on the map. And we talk about films like Election that I've covered in the podcast previously. There's a mention of Sideways as well. The Descendants actually doesn't come up, nor does Nebraska, but I recommend pretty much every film this man has made. Without further ado, I'm going to play you a snippet from the trailer of The Holdovers, and then we'll just go straight into it and my conversation with Alexander Payne.
Sir, I don't understand.
That's glaringly apparent.
I can't fail this class.
Oh, don't sell yourself short, Mr. Coates. I truly believe that you can.
Every year at Barton Academy, students, faculty, and staff depart the campus for a 2-week winter break. But there are always an unfortunate few who have nowhere to go for the holidays. They're known as the Holdovers.
Mr. Hunnam.
Hello, Mary.
I heard you got stuck with babysitting duty this year. How'd you manage that?
You know, he used to be a student, right?
Yeah, that's why he knows how to inflict maximum pain on us.
I thought all the Nazis were hiding in Argentina.
Stifle it, Tully.
You just earned yourself a detention, sir.
Being here with you is already one big detention.
Son of a bitch, that's another detention.
Do you think I want to be babysitting you? No, I was praying your mother would pick up the phone or your father would arrive in a helicopter or a flying saucer.
My father's dead.
That then was a clip from The Holdovers. I'm absolutely thrilled to be joined by its director and co-writer, Alexander Payne, who's joining me for a Film Stories podcast special. Hello, Alexander. How do we find you? How are you?
I'm well, thank you. Thanks, Simon. How are you doing today?
I am alive and I'm happy about that.
Good.
I've spoken to you once before, which was a few months after the release of Downsizing. You did something really unusual at the end of the interview, and I just wonder if I can start with that, because I've done quite a few interviews in my time, but I've never had someone ask me at the end, "Have I read any interesting books?" Which you did, just completely out of the blue, completely wrong-footed me. I'm just curious, do you do that a lot? Is that because you must do a squillion of these interviews when you've got something out? Is it a thing for you to ask something back like that?
I'm much more interested in asking questions of others than in being having questions asked of me. Yeah, and I said also when I do public appearances or public speaking, I think I'm a much better moderator and interviewer than interviewee.
Yeah. And so what do I mean, you say you're happier to a degree asking the questions. What do you get out of that then? Because I always
knowledge.
Think if but does it ever spark something for you? Is it just like, is it just making this part of the process a bit more human?
Well, look, years ago when I asked you, probably we had had a good, interesting discussion as we're beginning to have here.
Yeah.
And right. Very good. So, do you remember what book you told me you were reading back then?
Yeah, I do. And it was, I can't remember the exact title, but it was a book about the people whose job it was to interrogate Saddam Hussein.
Huh.
And wow. which we had a conversation about. And it was, the interesting thing for me was there was nothing really in it for you in terms of professionally. I didn't think you were going to take the suggestion and then turn it into a film and then we'd both appear on the Oscar stage. It was just, I bring it up because nobody else has done it. That's why it's so unusual from where I sit.
Well, I'm sorry you are subjected to such incurious.
No, not at all.
Incurious interlocutors.
it's not even that, is it? It's just where a human conversation goes sometimes. I recommend to you now a book called Killing Thatcher by Rory Carroll, which is about the IRA plot to assassinate Margaret Thatcher, which is nowhere near as tawdry as it sounds. It's an incredibly detailed, researched piece that's written with the electricity of a thriller as a mashup of different things. A million miles away from what I was expecting. Can I ask what you're reading then? Can I return that?
I'm not reading anything right now. Oh, you know what I have with? Well, I'm traveling a lot right now, so my reading is undisciplined.
Perfect.
I brought with me two books, which I dip into on the plane and before dotting off to sleep. The writer Harold Lamb, L-A-M-B, an accountant of Genghis Khan. I've got that.
Okay.
And I also have what I often take with me, especially if I haven't reread him in a while, Chekhov short stories. I'm a great fan of, not a huge fan of his plays, but I adore his short stories.
Well, if you need the lower brow recommendations, come to me. I'm always on hand.
No, those are pretty highbrow recommendations. By the way, speaking of Margaret Thatcher and mashups, have you seen the Chilean film El Conde?
I have not.
Oh, please do, because it imagines not only Augusto Pinochet as a centuries-old vampire, but also Margaret Thatcher as same.
Okay. I'm surprised it's not a hit in the UK.
It's been on Netflix for a few months.
It's an interesting time on Netflix as well that in the UK for the first time, and this is vaguely related to something I wanted to talk to you about. In the UK for the first time, the number one film on Netflix is not in the English language, which to my knowledge is the first time that has happened.
And it's one of the things I was going to bring up to you. I've gone right down my list of questions way too far already. But when I spoke to you before, you talked about how you were one of a small, it's your quote, I'm one of a small but hopefully growing number of American directors who can get decent sized budgets for what we call human or classic or adult or independent or whatever the whole word is. And this was, 2017. And I think then the movies had a little bit of a lull. But the point we're talking about here in the UK, we're on the verge of the release of The Zone of Interest, The Holdovers, All of Us Strangers, Saltburn. These really, and then the film that's topped the Netflix charts is J.A. Bayona's Society of the Snow. I'm just wondering if you're emboldened in any way that cinema seems to, for all the naysayers around it, had all these incredible films have bubbled up in one go.
Isn't that wonderful? Thank you for thank you for framing our contemporary cinema landscape that way. I think that's wonderful. Yes, I'm emboldened and encouraged by what you just described. That's true.
And it goes against an environment where, because I was quite downbeat it back in like October, November about movies when Jeff Nichols' film gets taken off the schedule and gets completely taken away. Jeff Nichols, I think, is a wonderful filmmaker. I can't wait to see his next film. I've never had the pleasure, but the work that he puts out is the work that I want to see. And I thought for a while it was getting harder to see. And yet The Holdovers, I mean, centering on that, is getting a cinema release at a point when a year or two ago, I just wonder if it would have even had that.
I think every year we inch away from the pandemic is encouraging for us to go back to the cinemas, and hopefully people will be back to the cinemas even more so a year from now.
So I mean, going specifically to The Holdovers, I mean, I sensed a frustration from time to time in your interviews. I've gone back over a few of them, that people like me on the journalistic side of the fence keep coming back to something like Sideways as the film that hits them hard. And I adore Sideways. But I'm also now a middle-aged man, genuinely a middle-aged man with a wonky eye who's losing his hair with nowhere to go in life. And so I sort of feel like you're throwing me personally fresh meat here. Now, you've talked in interviews about how you and David Hemmingson shaped the story, about the genesis of it. But the bit I'm really interested in is the tiny human moment in your head where something changes, that an idea in your head becomes something you want to commit 2 to 3 years of your life to. I always find this fascinating in filmmakers. Was there something distinctive here that just flicked the switch, if you will?
I call it the flash of an idea.
Lovely.
It's like a little tiny, you know, glowing piece of kryptonite or something.
Yeah.
And in my experience, it's rare to have that flash of an idea like, oh, bing, that could be a feature film.
Yeah.
In the case of The Holdovers, I had it, Simon, about a dozen years ago after watching a French film.
Malus, was it? Yeah.
Yeah, and it, which has a similar premise, not a similar story at all, but a similar, you know, first real premise. And I went, dink, that's a good idea for a movie, for a different movie. And then it was on my list. And at any time I have, you know, 8 or 10 film ideas that if I ever get around to them could be fashioned into decent screenplays, I feel. And this was one of them. And I just feel very lucky, very blessed that the gods sent unto me David Hemmingson, the writer who in whom I entrusted this premise. And he acquitted himself really marvelously with this screenplay.
Can I ask about those idea flashes that you just mentioned? You said that it's only happened a few times in your career. Can you kind of contain what the flash was with something like The Holdovers? And certainly, inevitably, what are the other flashes? What were the others?
All right, well, let me just go back in my own career.
Yeah.
Jim Taylor, my co-writer, and I were
living
together in Los Angeles, and I had already read the New York Times, and he read it after me and circled a story for me that I had ignored. about an American Indian woman, a Native American woman who had many abortions and had given birth to many children with birth defects. And she was arrested yet again for huffing paint down by the bus station in North Dakota.
And that was Citizen Ruth from that.
Citizen Ruth. And I read it and I had a flash. This could be a movie. This could be a comedy. So we wrote that. Election. I had been given this, the unpublished novel. I'd been given the unpublished novel, which I didn't want to read for months because it was set in a high school. And this during a period in the 90s where they were making all sorts of dreadful high school movies. And I told a friend of mine, I go, you know, I'm not interested in doing a high school movie. I'm pretentious. Yeah. And and he said, no, just read it. Just read it. And then I was reading. It's like, oh, well, this is pretty human. This is pretty interesting. And it came to a moment where the principal sniffed his watch band and it smelled bad.
I remember reading that. Yeah.
That rang a bell with me because I, at the same time, had a stinky watch band myself, and I hadn't gotten around to going to the jewelry shop and getting it replaced. So I thought, I want to make a movie that has a guy sniffing his stinky watch band in it. Now, that's not in the final movie, but it's telling about the sensibility of that novel.
Well, I was going to say, does there have to be a flash for you to decide to? Because I always think filmmakers are at heart slow storytellers. You're committing to something that takes 2 to 3 years to give us 2 hours. But do you have to have that flash to be able to commit to that?
Yes. How would you not have that? How would you? I mean, I use the word flash, but
yeah,
it's the decision, the interest in saying, oh, this is a path I want to follow. This is. You know, people ask me the question, which in my case is the wrong. What did you want to say with this film? What did you want to express with this film? Well, I didn't. I had to make the film in order to know why I wanted to make it in the first place.
Yeah.
And the thing is, too, as far as saying something or expressing something, that's not for me the first urge.
Yeah.
The first urge is I want to make a movie. And what's a premise that I can then figure out the skeleton of the plot and then add the meat and flesh of moments and dialogues and like the delight of the movie, the jokes, the poignancy, whatever it is. And that's where the, in quotes, expression comes.
Yeah.
That's where I see only after the fact what I've been thinking about, or if there are autobiographical elements that I'm even unconscious of.
Yeah,
I may not see them until years later. And then, oh, my God, look, yes, that was going on in my life. And look how it showed up in that work. And isn't that interesting? So there you have it.
No, that's great. And at the point where one of the interesting things about when I talked to you about downsizing was it was 2-3 months after the release of the film. And you were still willing to do an interview about it. It was out of what I'd consider like the promotional period. And so there was a degree of reflection on not critical response to a film, but audience response to a film. And I'm conscious that The Holdovers, rightly, is in the awards conversation now. It's already picking up awards. But part and parcel of that is I've heard you talking about you don't just attend the Q&As, you sit in and watch the film again and again with different audiences.
Not always. I do for a while. It's interesting. Yeah.
Well, that's kind of what I wanted to get to. Yeah.
No, a film is not complete without an audience.
Absolutely. But an audience, I'm curious what you take for effectively an American story in the 1970s. What do you take away when that audience is in a different country and responding in a slightly different way? What nuance can you detect in an audience as you take it around the world?
What if you look at your question a different way?
Yeah.
What if I'm watching the film in different places around the world? And they're actually responding to the same things at the same time.
Interesting. Yeah.
That's the miracle of cinema, is it not?
Yeah.
That's what Charlie Chaplin started to do 115 years ago, 110 years ago anyway, that people that when we had faith, not that I was alive then, that we had faith that cinema could unite the world, that without words, everyone around the world would see Charlie Chaplin and laugh at the exact same time and the exact same things and recognize in him a shared humanity. Isn't that what we want from cinema, ideally, from art, to recognize in this fractionalized world our shared humanity?
Yeah, absolutely. But so in terms of like my own response to it, putting aside like having to write about the film and stuff like that, just me as a human being responding to it, the bizarrest thing for me was I started thinking about the times I've met teachers outside of a school environment. and how it takes a little bit of time for the power dynamic that's usually established to leak away. And I just after seeing the film, bizarrely, I ended up thinking about that for about two, three hours about all the teachers I'd met outside of school and how it takes so much time for them to change. What are the little discoveries for you? Well, I mean, what do you take once you've not when you're putting the film together and writing it, but you said just then about how you get to the end and then you sort of realize what it was. What were the discoveries you were finding once you sat and watched your film?
First of all, I want to talk about what you're making me think about the interview process, like this discussion we're having, or maybe we don't, maybe yeah. we can call this more of a discussion, even though you're posing more questions than I am. One way in which I like many who work in the arts, I do work and prefer to work, and it's just how what the nature of work is unconsciously, consciously, but unconsciously. Like, I don't question what I'm doing. It's what feels right.
Yeah.
You know, you ask a painter, why that blue? I don't know. It just felt right in the moment. Leave me alone. Why that blue? Because that's what I wanted. God damn it. So then after working in an unconscious way, if the film merits some, and I'm grateful for it, merit is getting some attention and there's interest in it. And then it's getting enthusiastic distribution by the distributor, by the studio. And they want to push the actor and the director, the actors and the director out there to get free real estate, you know, in print. So yeah. They have to pay for all the marketing. And also because some, you know, a lot of people are interested in what directors and actors might have to say. God help them. Then I'm kind of forced to think about you to it, that's when you're forced to make conscious and unconscious process.
Yeah.
And as articulate as I try to be as a human being, you know, I'm often asked questions that I just have to say, I don't know, leave me alone. Like earlier today, I fielded an interview question about, oh, your archetype in many of your films tends to be the flawed American male who, you know, does this and that. It's like, I'm so tired of that question. Like, because I don't have a good answer for it. You know, I can say, well, that's a comic archetype that, you know, and many people who make comedies over the years have a certain, you know, Jacques Tati had his, Buster Keaton had his, Harold Lloyd had his, maybe for Jim Taylor and me as writers and me as director, it's this variety of downtrodden human, maybe, but maybe not. I don't know. Nor are all my movies that.
Yeah.
Well, so it's an interesting, the interview process is, let me just say this too, it's much easier to talk about process than it is about theme or metaphor or why, perché, you know, why. It just is. I understand it, but it's slightly puzzling for me. Now, that's a separate, Simon, I'm getting to what your question is. Sorry for I'm being a bit long-winded.
No, this is interesting.
And then even after that, after all of that hullabaloo passes and years go by, and I don't see a film for years, then I can maybe look at it with fresh eyes and with critical eyes. I saw Downsizing for the first time since it had come out last summer, and I was curious to see what that would be. I saw Sideways a couple of months ago for the first time because this year, 2024, marks its 20th anniversary.
Yeah.
And the studio had never struck a DCP. It still existed.
Not right.
Film and whatever the digital form is for, you know, for Blu-ray and DVD, but they hadn't made a DCP. So I was present at the transfer of that. I hadn't seen it. It was interesting to see that movie again. So it's nice when years go by and you can look at something anew, something freshly. The Latin poet Horace used to recommend 8 years as the time to leave a poem before you correct it.
So what was your, I mean, you said earlier that it's the audience that completes the circle.
100%.
As it were.
Absolutely.
Yeah. But at some point, you've then become the audience of your own film.
Later.
That you, yeah. So I don't know, just picking side. films are. What's your the process of making the film is the process of making the film. You're good at that. I'm not. The bit where you just as a human being strip the filmmaker away, stop and look at something that was an expression of where you were as a filmmaker for whether you see it like that or not 20 years ago. Then with 20 years of added life experience that you've got now and presumably all the things you know how to do and don't know how to do now, what was just the moment like of watching that?
Well, first of all, so much time goes by.
Yeah.
You can edit out that long pause.
No, I'll keep it in. That's cool.
When so much time goes by, it's nice usually I do. I transcend the self-criticism of like, oh my God, why did I do that? Oy vey, why did I do that? And you get to a point where you accept who that, you said filmmaker, but it's filmmaker, human being, who one was as a human being 20 years ago. So it's, you know, I forgive myself for this excess or that excess. And I just see it as a snapshot of where I was, as you say, as a filmmaker, and then by extension, as a human being.
Yeah.
I also allow myself to do something I won't allow myself, which is to pay myself a compliment. Like there are passages of Sideways, I thought, that's so good. I hope I'd be able to do that again.
Yeah.
And, you know, you talk about accumulating experience and know-how over time. There's also losing things over time as well.
Yes.
You know, is it not common, do you not see many filmmakers and many artists and other media as well whose earlier work surpasses that of their later work?
Yes.
And one certainly doesn't want, I mean, that's the Orson Welles curse, isn't it? That he made his masterpiece at age 25. And to some degree, it was downhill from there.
But that also bakes in an assumption, doesn't it? That even if you make your greatest work when you're 20, it doesn't mean that make when you're 80, for instance, doesn't get to someone, doesn't have significance to someone, that saying something's their greatest work almost reduces it to a degree to a Rotten Tomatoes kind of thing. Whereas I was talking to Andrew, who's just made All of Us Strange, and his argument is at no point in your life will you make a perfect film, even with what you've got in front of you at that moment in time, nothing you do will be entirely perfect. And it's only, as you say, it's the passage of time that fills in some of the gaps. I think Tom Hanks was really interested about that last year, about time completes the movie. But even when people talk about their worst, it's quite hard not to have something in it, isn't it?
Not to have what?
Not to have something that hits someone somewhere. I mean, it comes out primal level to how do we judge what is the best thing ever and what is brilliant and what isn't. It's a human reaction, isn't it?
My pause is that I'm thinking, I'm trying to absorb what you just said, because we have a lot of different thought balls.
I appreciate that. I do that a lot.
In the air right now. Look, all I can say is, in many cases, maybe not all cases, but in many cases, film directors' work decreases in quality with age. Tarantino's been talking about that, and
he has,
he wants to retire because he doesn't want to fall into that trap. You know, we'll see. But Buñuel can. Here's an interesting quote. Let me throw this into the mix.
Yeah,
this is a Lena Wertmüller quote. She said, an artist can lose many things, and of course she means filmmaker first and foremost, but an artist can lose many things over the years, but can never lose anger. And I
think that's interesting.
He's talking about, you know, in that your work is infused with a certain urgency and vitality to say something, to express something, to feel something and make others feel it. And I think certainly like with a lot of Hollywood directors, you know, who start smoking the Hollywood crack pipe and get rich and fancy and stuff, their work decreases in urgency and can often do. I don't want to name names. But then you have Buñuel, who made arguably one of his finest films when he was 77 years old, his last film, That Obscure Object of Desire. His powers never decreased. John Huston, to some degree, continued to make very good films toward the end, until the end.
So now, Alan Parker stopped making films, didn't he? Because he just said that directors just keep remaking their old films. I disagree with that.
What was his last film? I was just
mentioning Angela's Ashes, which is quite distinct from what he'd done before as well.
I said to someone yesterday in conversation, I miss Alan Parker films.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. I mean, Alan Parker would take an absolute punt and would take a risk and wasn't concerned, I don't think, with legacy. Perhaps up until the end he may have been. But again, I don't know him. You know, I never met him. I never talked to him. My only relationship with him, as is my only relationship with you, is through the work outside of these conversations that we've been able to have. Mm-hmm. I find it. I've got a minute or two left, and I just think we've kind of talked the interview process here, which I never get to do. And I find that quite interesting that this form that we're having is never dissected to some degree, because at heart, what's brought us together is you 12 years ago had a eureka moment that ultimately led to this. I went into a screening room the start of November and came out very moved by what I'd seen and a determination to speak to you again off the back of that, facilitated by the hidden heroes on this call who never get a thank you to the hidden heroes on the call, because they work tirelessly to put this kind of stuff together. I still think it's such a tweet question, but there is still magic here, isn't there, going back to kind of what we were talking before about what cinema can do and what cinema has done. Ultimately, we're back at human beings, that this is it's a collection of points, granted, but it's human beings have been brought together by a film again, by someone telling a story over the course of 2-3 years.
I think film is marvelous in that regard.
Yeah.
How it brings people together. Sometimes I'm in, you know, I'm on the promotional, I call it the golden gerbil wheel of film promotion. Yeah. You know, it's a gerbil wheel, but it's a privilege. Yeah. It's a privileged place to be. And I'll be at a dinner. You know, or heck, you know, I was showing the film at the Thessalonica Film Festival in Greece in November.
Yeah.
And there, just before the film was going to start, I hosted a luncheon for members of my, you know, my second cousins and their kids. You know, I happen to be Greek American.
Yeah.
And my ex-wife's extended family was there, and our child was there. And I have some old, you know, good friends who were there. And I just said to everyone, look at what film does. This table, this moment, this event, this lunch would not have existed in this form if I had made this movie, and by extension, if the cinema didn't exist at all. Like, how lucky are we? And I think our job is just to pay attention to those moments and value them and treasure them. They're fleeting.
Alexander Payne, we're out of time, so I'm going to pledge to track you down in 8 years' time to watch The Holdovers with you. If that's okay. I'd genuinely be fascinated at your response to it. Thank you so much for your time. And I wish you all the best with the film. Huge congratulations on it. It's a very special one.
I wish you the best too for the new year, Simon. Thank you.
Thank you. And enjoy your books. Take care.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
And that was my conversation with Alexander Payne. As I mentioned at the start, the wonderful The Holdovers is playing in cinemas now. You can expect to hear a lot of it over the next couple of months from when this is recorded. I expect it to be in serious Oscar contention. I really hope Paul Giamatti wins an Oscar. I don't care massively for the Oscars. However, Paul Giamatti has been doing superb work. Go back to American Splendor. What a film that was. Paul Giamatti deserves every prize on the planet, as far as I'm concerned. And that brings me to the end of this latest special episode of Film Stories. So, as always, thank you for listening and thank you for your time. You can find more from me on Twitter at Simon Brew. You can find more from the entire Film Stories project at Film Stories. If you like what we do, head to patreon.com/Simon Brew. You can get podcast early and ad free by putting money in the pot here. They're not this particular podcast early, as it happened, just because it was a very late one that I was desperately keen to do and get out. Our website, filmstories.co.uk, updated every weekday. There's loads of stuff on there. And then our magazines, our print magazines are for sale. store.filmstories.co.uk. Two more to tell you about very, very, very shortly. But I'm in danger of outstaying my welcome, so I'm going to round this off and thank you so much for listening. And thank you for your time. If you can leave a really nice review, if you can subscribe to this podcast, it's hugely appreciated. Whether you do so or not, take care. Thank you for your time. Thank you for listening. I'll be back soon with some more film stories. Bye-bye.